we get it underway in a very fine way this afternoon, because we've butt dialed one of our favorite guests on the show, David Roth of Deadspin. Hello, David.
Hi, Rich. How are you? It's nice to have another person knowingly on the line with me.
What's going on? Your dad's having a problem with technology here?
That's been a decades long struggle for him. But yes, today I was telling Carrie before we came on that during the 10 or 15 minutes before we spoke, my dad was calling me without knowing just 3 times in 15 minutes, which is a lot even for him. He's got a new phone and I think he's kind of breaking it in.
Well, I want to start with a fairly serious topic here. Usually we go on the lighter side of things, but I think this is important. Is it safe to say that you believe the Olive Bar at your local supermarket is an accurate microcosm of America in 2019?
I mean, it certainly points to all of the different problems that New York City has just in terms of livability. First of all, I'm pleased that you've been listening to the Deadcast. It makes me happy.
Of course.
It's a story that I told that I was embarrassed about, in part because it involves an old lady elbowing me in the throat. Which is not the sort of thing that one usually brags about, but it's real. It happened. But she wanted olives more than me that day.
Well, the supermarket in general, we were talking about this a couple of weeks ago. Man, it's a war zone out there. Some of the worst behavior you'll see. And it's not even just in the store. It's in the parking lot with people jockeying for position.
The parking lot stuff has always been, living in a city that doesn't have as much of a car culture, I've forgotten this. I mean, it was a fact of life. I grew up in New Jersey. Like, every possible space in that state is, basically somewhere you can have an argument or are actively having an argument. That's how people understand it. The parking lot stuff, though, all these years I'd kind of let that memory atrophy. And then I was up in Maine, actually, around the holiday. And I'll tell you, it's a lot of really nice people. But once you get them near a Shaw's, it just really changes.
Oh, there's no question about that. Well, yes, you did spend some time in Maine, as you do every year around the holidays. How was your visit? You know, as soon as you left, we went and got us a new governor, so we're not a punchline anymore.
Yeah, I don't want to take all the credit for that, but I do appreciate you pointing to the work I did on that, which I think involved, two tweets over 8 years about Paul LePage looking like he was melting or something. My mother-in-law was extremely pleased by that. I think my father-in-law was too, but she tends to bring up LePage more often. I think more often than most people on average. But yeah, it seemed nice. It was not as scenic as past Maine Christmases, but it was also, delightful experience at the Portland Jetport as always. And I like being up there for Christmas. It's easy as a non-Christian to split these holidays up with my wife, who is. And so I'm still kind of a stranger in a strange land there, but I enjoy eggnog and decorated trees and all that. However touristic it is, I always enjoy it.
I have to go back to something that was on the Deadcast, too. And I won't even go near the whole pancake debate or French toast, but what's your problem with yogurt?
I myself do not have a significant problem with yogurt. I just, except for the fact that I don't really feel like eating it ever. And I think it's for babies. But beyond that, I think it's useful in cooking and all of that. That was the thing that I was most maybe taken aback by there was my former editor-in-chief, now the editor-in-chief of Special Products or Special Projects at GMG, Tim Marchman, is a fanatical yogurt adherent. And I was sort of just surprised by the passion of his argument on behalf of full fat Greek yogurt. I haven't heard him be that excited about anything having to do with work. I mean, I respect it. I was just taken aback.
I understand. We're talking with David Roth of Deadspin here. Let's talk a little baseball. If I'm reading correctly in a piece you posted this week, you're telling me that even the bad baseball owners have money to spend?
Well, it's strange, isn't it? Yes. part of the reason that I wrote that was just that I am frustrated by all the sort of pettifoggery surrounding Manny Machado and Bryce Harper and this idea that teams keep coming up with more unconvincing reasons why they can't sign to obvious future Hall of Famers that would make their teams much better. But what I learned, I wrote the team essay for the Pittsburgh Pirate in the Baseball Perspective annual this year, which will be out sometime in the next couple months. And that team is, I had always just sort of associated them with this consciously cheap middle tier, you know, organization. And they were bad for a long time. It looked like they were almost going to get good. They didn't spend, and then they kind of got mediocre again. What I didn't know is that their owner is fantastically rich, and that they is, you know, the 10th richest owner, according to Forbes' accounting anyway, in the major leagues. The family is worth well more than $1 billion. And the team itself has continued to shrink its payroll down to now they're basically in the Tampa Bay Rays neighborhood, like the nice part of the Rays neighborhood, but still that neighborhood. And there's just no reason for it. I mean, they had a shot, a real shot, a few years ago at doing what the Brewers did this year and making a respectable push towards the World Series, just opted out. And as usual with these BP essays, they tend to give me depressing teams every year, I think, just because it's fun to watch me get mad. I wound up getting quite heated about it. It was really frustrating. It's one thing when the Mets are just owned by incompetence. The team had a real shot and just didn't shoot it.
Well, did you hear the news about the Tampa Bay Rays today, who don't draw flies to their games, and now they're getting rid of some of the seats at the Trop, but they're getting rid of the cheap seats. So if we're only going to get 20,000 people or 15,000, let's at least make them pay.
Savvy play there. Got to respect it. That's veteran economics there. Because if you want to try to develop a fan base and you don't have a fan base, what you got to do is make the tickets extremely expensive and hard to obtain. That's just basic. I know I'm not telling you anything you don't know.
No, that's a common business strategy right there.
It's so puzzling to me. I mean, it's not puzzling. I mean, you know what they're trying to do. But there's something about the idea of, like, it just seems like it was not devised by anyone that was a baseball fan. Like, you know, I don't know about the owners or the executives' upbringing or whatever, but as a child going to baseball games, if there weren't such things as $5 or $8 seats, I wouldn't have gone. And it wasn't because my family was, you know, penniless or anything like that. It's just, you know, you take a kid to a baseball game and you have to throw all kinds of garbage at them in order to make them sit there throughout the game for a while anyway. And then that diminishes as they either begin to care about baseball or don't. But I stuck with this stupid team for 40 years certainly against my better judgment, but I mean, against the advice of a lot of people that care about me. And it's all because of the fact that I was there when I was 7 years old on a $5 ticket with my parents. The idea that the Rays are passing on that is puzzling to me.
Well, we make those attachments. And then even teams that are successful, you know, like World Championship successful. Now, the Red Sox made it wasn't a formal announcement, but said sort of offhand at the beginning of the offseason, we've really got to consider cutting payroll. They've got a license to print money there at both the ballpark and with their cable network, but they're talking about cutting back, which now appears to be nothing more than a strategy to try and get Craig Kimbrel down to a more affordable salary.
Yeah, which is, I mean, and I suppose it's business is business. It's not like there was a time when baseball owners were, you know, decent or happy to pay people what they were worth. I mean, the Red Sox are one of two teams that actually went above the luxury tax threshold last year, which teams everywhere else just decided to sort of treat it as a de facto salary cap. And I think I was most surprised in writing about the sort of cheap, cheesy off-season stuff that we've had so far, is that the penalty that the Red Sox paid for going over was nothing. It was $12 million, and they moved down 10 slots in the June draft. But as somebody at Over the Monster pointed out, which is a good Red Sox blog, that $12 million is what the team paid Ruzmi Castillo to play at Pawtucket.
That's right.
It's nothing. And the idea that, you know, I understand that teams don't want to pay more, but, like, neither do I. I still, like, I have... And yet, if I were to start showing up at work in clothes with, like, larger holes or more conspicuous stains in them, I think people would get justifiably upset.
Speaking of baseball, I was smiling this week as you brought up the legendary Lou Ford and made the connection between Lou Ford and that noted political maverick, Mitt Romney.
Maverick Mitt, certainly one of the most reckless and freewheeling of our public Americans. What was the network that referred to him and Ben Sasse as was it the NBC or something like that?
I think incoming
Senate mavericks, replacing the other guys that act upset when they vote for whatever it is that Trump feeds them.
When I see Mitt Romney in his dad jeans, in my head, I hear he's a rebel.
He is, I mean, you see it. Basically imagining him stepping off a motorcycle being like, what are you rebelling against? The video that, this is, you know, a couple hops down late night Twitter, but there's a video from the Netflix documentary about Mitt's campaign in which he attempts to iron a shirt cuff while he is wearing that shirt, while various members of his family are like, don't do that, dude. That's a really bad idea. And he's like, oh, I can do it. And it reminded me of a story that I'd actually written about during the postseason, which was that John Smoltz was famously written about as having done the same thing back when he was with the Braves. And he was already an all-star by then or whatever, but it was like some news of the weird thing that appeared in the Journal Constitution. And the story's followed him for 25 years. He says it is totally false. And there's a similar story about Lou Ford, as a true guy to remember and a Long Island Ducks legend closer to me, who may actually have done the same thing. I believe he also denied it, but I think that the reporting was better on that one. Either way, it's almost certain that Mitt Romney is the only person ever to have attempted to iron a shirt while he was doing it. But that's why it's Maverick.
Exactly. Hey, well, what's the best story in the NBA this year from your perspective?
So this is recency bias, I'm sure. For me, like, Harden has been great. I have been fascinated by how good Paul George is and blown away by how good Paul George has been. The Thunder are not a team that I ever think that I really want to watch because I sort of associate them with, like, I think Russell Westbrook is way more compelling to think about than to watch play basketball for the most part. And he hasn't been great this year. And he's been sort of the less efficient version of himself. But George has been, every time I've seen him, has looked as good as any player in the NBA. And I think some of that's just that he's played, you know, in comparative media backwaters for his whole career or whatever. I'm constantly surprised to the extent where I should probably not be surprised anymore by how great he's been. Harden has been fantastic, but is also still kind of hell to watch. George is awesome. He reminds me of McGrady.
I have to ask you about the president. Of course, we would be remiss in not bringing him up, but especially what went on over the holidays with him. Apparently, I picture it as like the really bad sequel to Home Alone. President there in the White House somewhere with only a phone and nothing else to do with his time.
I had a similar thought. I mean, I don't know what he does most days anyway, if we're being honest. I mean, yes, it was clear that like by choosing not to go down to Mar-a-Lago where he could congratulate and be congratulated by a series of thrice divorced plastic surgeons that constitute his friend group. Obviously that was a sacrifice on his part, but at the same time, him just like rattling around an empty White House with Fox News on every television, anywhere in every room he entered, just seems, I mean, it seems like it would be specifically the version of hell that would be devised for me if I were to really not get my act together over the next however many years I've got. But it also is just, as with a lot of things with him, like there's something almost sad about it until you realize that there's really kind of nothing to pity there, that this is 100% his choice, his devising.
Maybe it was the time he had last week is when he learned all of his expertise on drones.
Drones, he's gotten really good at drones. My new favorite Trump trope, which, you know, these two tend to cycle in and out. I love his claiming expertise on technological things, which is always great. His new thing is he likes to bring up wheels in connection with the wall.
Right.
Where he's like, walls work, wheels work. We don't, and you can kind of see, like, if you, depending on where you situate him on the continuum of cognitive decline, which, you know, I'm not a doctor. I know a lot about drones, but I don't know that much about what might be going on inside of his head. I think the idea that those two words kind of are similar to each other has a great deal to do with their appeal to him. But the idea that, like, simply because, you know, some of your famous empires, the Roman Empire, which of course still stands today, famously built a lot of really great walls, that, like, because that is the same thing as a wheel, which is still a concept we have, I can't follow it all the way. I can get like 75% of the way there, and then I just get so tired.
I think you're right, though, and I think it's just another step on the path that if it goes on a whole lot longer, he'll be down to one-word sentences.
Yeah, which is, I mean, honestly, would be a blessing. Like, if he just communicated through a series of, like, clicks and snarls, I think that the discourse would improve by, you know, 100% or so. It's just, I don't know, man. I mean, the stuff today, we're talking about how he wants to keep the government closed for months or years. It's not even clear what he wants or how you could even give it to him. I think that a great deal of this is tied up in his personal weirdnesses, and he's had all life to work those out, and he hasn't done it.
I think eventually, if the Democrats just offer him like a little miniature of the Great Wall of China, you know, just like a keychain miniature, go, here, here's your wall, and that will satisfy him. He'll be happy.
That's the dream. I mean, eventually, if you just wait, and then at some point, like, 2 weeks from now, he's holding up a John Wall Wizards jersey, and he's like, we did it, folks. Terrific. Here it is.
Somebody put it on Twitter, and it was great. Either that or the miniature Stonehenge from Spinal Tap.
Knows who they were. It would be an exciting time if they thought that would work. And I have this feeling that he's just, the thing that he wants is to take something from somebody that they don't want to give him. And so I don't know how you get to yes with that. It's like trying to get a child a nap or something like that. I think at some point you just have to wait until he gets too tired to do anything else.
Well, fingers crossed for that. David Roth of Deadspin and the Deadcast. Always great to talk with you, my friend. Happy New Year to you, if it's not too late in 2019 to say that. And we look forward to
not
catching up with you again very soon. And especially now that, you know, we've got a different governor, we can talk more often.
It'll be nice. Right on, guys. Happy New Year to you folks.
Thanks, David. That's David Roth here on Downtown.